From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The philosopher and social critic Mortimer Adler has recently published a book entitled The Paideia Proposal, on behalf of the Paideia Group, an assembly of educators, administrators, and publishers. Soundings now presents the first in a series of conversations about the Paideia Proposal with Mortimer Adler and several teachers, administrators, and writers. The word paideia derives from a Greek term which signifies the upbringing of a child. In a larger sense, paideia connotes the necessary cultural knowledge which forms the basis for meeting the duties of individual citizenship, the responsibilities of work, and the obligations of personal development. Professor Adler calls the Paideia Proposal a revolutionary indictment of multi-track education in the United States, inasmuch as he argues for equal educational opportunity for American youngsters in qualitative as well as quantitative terms. According to Adler, primary and secondary American education should be general, liberal, and humanistic, rather than specialized, vocational, or technical. In all of this, Adler argues for the integration of three kinds of learning. First, the acquisition by students of organized knowledge. Second, the development of intellectual skills. And third, the enlargement of understanding, ideas, and values. The following portion of the discussion includes Mortimer Adler, Edward Fort, and Gilbert Sewell. Professor Adler is director of the Institute for Philosophical Research and chairman of the Board of Editors of Encyclopedia Britannica. Edward Fort is chancellor of North Carolina A&T University. Gilbert Sewell was education editor at Newsweek magazine and has recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he wrote a book dealing with curriculum reform in American secondary schools.
The generally prevalent error on the part of teachers, educators, and parents, and the children themselves, is that one gets an education in school. This is absolutely false. No one can become educated in school. The reason for that is that youth, immaturity, is an insuperable obstacle of becoming educated. Education can only take place in adult life by continued learning. Since that is the case, if our ideal is to produce educated men and women, the schools must, first of all, more than anything else, prepare for the continuation of learning. They must give the young the skills of learning, an introduction to the world of learning, and an incentive to go on learning. For if adults don't go on learning in their adult years, mature years, the whole of schooling is wasted except for practical purposes. No one becomes an educated human being till well past 40. But let me say, the one thing we didn't do is hand out a curriculum. There's not a curriculum. In each case, whether it's in Atlanta, or in Chicago, or in Springfield, Ohio, or in Dallas, Texas, the local school group will make its own curriculum within the framework indicated. All the options are open except something that's mandatory. The three kinds of teaching, the three kinds of learning, that there'd be no vocational instruction anywhere in the first 12 years, that'd be completely general and unspecialized, that a second language be required, with a choice of that second language among six languages, German, French, Italian, Spanish, Russian, and Chinese.
Dr. Adler, I'd like to ask a question about one rather interesting and intriguing aspect of your proposal that I'm rather fascinated with. That concerns the emphasis upon general education at the K-12 level, with the so-called specialization phase coming at post-secondary education. You recall that less than a decade ago, the public schools were heavily involved, and I might add, in line with the interface with the United States Office of Education at the time, in a massively contrived move to bring career education preparation down to literally the kindergarten level and move from there up in stages. This received awesome amounts of support, both fiscally and organizationally, from the U.S. office. It also was embellished in many of the large urban school districts nationally. I would perceive that it might very well be that those that were involved in that movement nationally might very well have some difficulty now switching gears and moving into this non-vocational or career education specific strategy. What would be your comment with regard to the attempt to dissuade that perception from continuing, given the fact that it received a tremendous amount of publicity and action a decade ago?
Two things. I have a Newsweek piece here in front of me which indicates the shifting job market for the future. I don't think one of the reasons for abolishing specialized, particularized job training in the schools now, because it will be out of date as soon as the children get out of school. The shift in the next 20 years in what jobs will be available and the character of the jobs makes it very important to postpone, I would think, any particularized job training until the child is almost, the young person is almost on the verge of taking up a career. And what he should get in school is the kind of flexible adjustment to the whole world of work that he can shift jobs as the technology causes that shift to take place. Now, here's a list of jobs that are going out, ones that are growing, and those that are limited for the future. And I think it's a very significant thing that, with the future of robotry, robots that make robots controlled by computers that are programmed, most unskilled and semi-skilled jobs will be out. And we have to have a different kind of training in the schools for a broader, more general adaptation to the world of work. That's my answer. Then I think, on the other hand, if there are specialized skills that have to be acquired, they can be acquired after general education is completed at the 12-year level, in community colleges, in special technical institutes, or I think the industry should take on the public responsibility of training on the job, because that's where it really should be done. It is there that the training can be most apt and most productive, rather than in school.
But hasn't that always been the case? And aren't corporations ever more taking on this responsibility?
They are. And matter of fact, they do it, which indicates how useless the specialized job training in the schools. They have to retrain on the job anyway, because the schools can't do it. They're always out of it. The vocational education, I think, was always a great myth. It was advocated and supported as being practical. It was very, very opposite of being practical.
It's interesting now that the Chamber of Commerce has come to adopt this point of view after many, many years of talking up vocational education. They now say, we want students skilled in the basics and ready for rapid on-the-job training.
Precisely the point. Couldn't be better said. In any case, if there's any priority, as between general and specialized, general comes first and specialized comes second. And since we can no longer hope for general education at the college level, specialization, choice of majors, look at any college. The Harvard College catalog has 4,000 courses offered. Look at the North Carolina College catalog. It's absurd in terms of general education. The Harvard core curriculum is not general education, as the dean will tell you if he's allowed to speak in private. There's a compromise with the graduate faculties all along the line. We've lost general education in this country, and the place to restore it is at the level of basic schooling. And with that done, then we can have all the specializations. I'd like to have every college have this required minor to continue some general humanistic learning along with specialization. I'd like to even see that in the law schools and the medical schools. I'd like to see that some general humanistic learning goes all the way through the school system. May I add one more thing? The thing I'd like to recommend that all of you look at sometime, because the man called the shots perfectly, is Ortega y Gasset's Revolt of the Masses, written in 1930. Chapter 8 is called The Barbarism of Specialization. And that chapter says what's happened in the 20th century, not just in the United States, but all over the world. Culture is on the way out, because culture is the general cultivation of the mind, the basic ideas are the framework of any culture. Ortega has very unkind words to say about the learned ignoramuses that are our doctors and our lawyers and our professors of this and that. And he's quite right. We tried, let me say, Mr. Hutchins tried a revolution in Chicago beginning in 1930. It took us 12 years, from 1930 to 1942, to create a college program against the full weight of the graduate faculty in opposition. There was a completely required program for all the children as a form of general education. Within 12 months of Mr. Hutchins leaving the University of Chicago to the Ford Foundation, that program is completely dismantled. In other words, if you allow the graduate school, which is, happens in most universities, to control the college, you can't have general education in the college. It's impossible. Because the graduate school is the PhD place, the place of high specialization, detailed, infinite specialization. And they're not interested. The graduate school is not at all interested in general education. They're interested in the college as a feeding ground, like a minor league in the feeding players into the major leagues.
Dr. Adler, let me raise another question. Edward Ford again. The other concept amongst many that you defined and moved forward on in your proposal that intrigues me heavily is that a concern with the equalization of educational opportunity?
Yeah.
It's been my own experience in the public school arena that, like it or not, there is an extraordinarily large number of persons, including parents, not just kids, in the K-12 arena, who insist upon a multi-track system because they view that as the only way whereby ultimately, if their kids are bright, they're going to get a piece of the pie once they graduate and go into the university, if in fact that's their goal. My question is, how would you envision that that thought, that attitude, that thesis can be overcome in relationship to this move, dramatically so I might add, to move away from the multi-tracked operation into a single track and therefore do away with educational elitism?
It seems to me that none of the things those parents want for their children would be impaired by the single track. In fact, they'd be facilitated by it. We're saying that all the children, all, without exception, all except those, shall I say, who are in asylums for the feeble-minded, shall have mathematics up through calculus, shall have natural science up through physics, shall have basic introduction to literature and the fine arts, shall have history and geography and the social studies for 12 years, and in addition to that, the training in all these basic skills and an introduction to the life of the mind, all for all the children. And let me comment at once, and none of the members of this group are unrealistic. We know that the children come to school with different aptitudes and different propensities and different rates of learning. They come from different kinds of homes, some that are culturally disadvantaged, some that are culturally advantaged. And we've borrowed from the French, who are very bright about this, two devices for handling individual differences. We're saying the same program for all, but accommodated to individual differences in the following way. The French, I don't know that they saw that this is a borrowing from our head start, but they invented the idea of the École Maternelle, which is a kind of preschool tutelage, either 3 years or 2 years or 1 year, for those children who come from homes that need to be prepared for school where the home doesn't do it. We think that's a fine idea. We thought Head Start was a fine idea for overcoming cultural disadvantages in the environment of the home. Secondly, they advocate remedial instruction. They don't mean by remedial instruction what we mean by it, where you make up in high school what wasn't done in elementary school, or you make up in college what wasn't done in high school. That's the wrong meaning of remedial instruction. They mean that in a class where some children are lagging behind, going more slowly, not doing as well, that child needs individual attention, gets remedial instruction to keep them abreast of the others as they advance from year to year. We also think that 12 years may be the mean time that some children could complete this program in less than 12 years, 1 or 2 years less, and some in 1 or 2 years more. There's no reason 12 years is merely the average in the distribution. So we think that what the parents want for their children, and let me say why we'd like to persuade them. Their children in our kind of society are all going to be citizens. That's the highest office in the land. It is the citizens are the principal and permanent rulers of this country. The office holders in Washington are the transient instrumental rulers and responsible to the citizens. If we took citizenship seriously as we should in a constitutional government, we ought to prepare the young for a decent participation and intelligent participation in political life. Two, they're all going to hold a variety of jobs in a rapidly changing technological environment. They're to be properly prepared generally for the world of work. And three, most important of all, the quality of life is the most important point. That quality of life for all should be one in which learning continues. It doesn't end with school, and the school should prepare them for that quality of life in which learning is an essential component year after year. It seems to me that the parents would understand that. If they also understood, this is a better adaptation to the world of work than what is now being offered.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first in a series of conversations with the philosopher and social critic Mortimer Adler, who has recently published The Paideia Proposal, a book which Adler calls an educational manifesto. The Paideia proposal calls for liberal, humanistic, and general curricula in American primary and secondary schools. Adler's proposal aims to offset what he views as the dangers of early specialization and an unnecessary emphasis on vocational and technical training. Soundings invited Professor Adler to discuss the Paideia proposal with several educators and administrators. In addition to Mr. Adler, the following portion of the conversation includes Harold Doster, Gilbert Sewell, Joan Stewart, and Thomas Houlihan. Harold Doster is president of Atlantic Christian College, a liberal arts institution located in Wilson, North Carolina. Gilbert Sewell held a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he completed a book on educational reform in American secondary schooling. Joan Stewart is currently a scholar at the National Humanities Center working on a book about French women novelists. Thomas Houlihan is principal of the Clayton, North Carolina High School. Here is Harold Doster.
Dr. Adler, that's the point. This is Hal Doster here.
Yes.
I think Ed makes a very good point about the fear of those who want a very difficult design in terms of preparation for college, but I fear more those who want their children adequately trained. I think the pressures are apt to come more from that side of the parental population than from the other side with this kind of curriculum. I say that as a liberal arts college president, where one of the complaints that we constantly have is you've prepared someone who is not really ready for the job market.
But it seems to me that I've often said, even though it might produce the wrong reaction from my hearers, that the parents of this country are the school's worst enemy. They think that the school's main job is to prepare their children to earn a living. Earning a living is not the main job. It's necessary, but secondary. Just as bread is, we don't live by bread alone, so we don't. Living which includes earning a living only is not a good life. A good human life, a human life in which the fullest development of one's human potentialities is achieved, is what the school should aim at. The parents must understand that earning a living is only one of the two aims of the school. The other is leading a decent human life. And the kind of schooling we're talking about aims at that primarily, prepares for the secondary end, secondarily earning a living, and hopes that that if further education is needed, it is done at the public expense in junior colleges, community colleges, or publicly supported technical institutes, or on the job. Let me say, I think I could meet those parents better if I had persuaded my colleagues to make one change that I could not get them to go along with me on. I wanted to move basic schooling down 2 years, from age 4 to 16. I would like to give the baccalaureate degree, forget the BA, the baccalaureate high school degree, the licentiate in France, at age 16. Now, that age, there's plenty of time left to prepare to earn a living in technical institutes or on the job in one way or another. I think early learning is, we've now discovered that early learning is highly profitable, that the mind is quite ready to learn it in the Montessori schools at age 2.5 and 3. But I could not persuade my colleagues of this because they thought that would raise problems with labor unions, with the economy in general. But even at 18, it is not, we're not asking for a postponement of particularized job training too long. I think you're right. The parents have to be persuaded. And I'm hoping that this book helps to persuade them. If I had gotten enough money from the foundations, my greatest hope was to get airplanes to drop this book in quantity on all the towns and hamlets of the United States.
Even though your colleagues may not have gone along with that aspect of the proposal that is moving the school up, I think it comes through very clearly that you are talking about a 15-year type of program. What concerns me a little bit is the moving of such a potent value system, which has pretty much been handled by the home and by the families, into those earlier years. How do you envision doing that?
Well, if you ask me what the single greatest obstacle that I don't know how to overcome, but none of us knows how to overcome, to the success of this program, It's one Mr. Hutchins would refer to again and again. He said, in order to produce the education revolution we need in this country, we must first have a moral, intellectual, and spiritual revolution, change the values of the country. Then he would go on to say, but of course, in order to get that moral, spiritual, intellectual, and spiritual revolution, we have to have the education revolution first. And around in the circle he went. Now, how to break into that vicious circle, I don't know. That is, if this education were in place, the next generation would not be an opponent of it, you see. The parents who have not had this kind of schooling and don't understand what the value of true schooling is may be the opponents of it, but how do you persuade them to let their children have this, you see? I don't know the answer to that question. And one overcomes it by missionary work. How do you convert the heathen?
Since we're not likely to see a massive spiritual revolution in the next 3 years.
Not the next 3 years, no.
Would it make more sense, would it be more practical and realistic to aim your proposal at a great majority of children or 90% of children rather than hammering away using that word all?
I think we would not like to compromise even by 1%. The democracy, we are firmly committed to the democratic principle of equality. No individual is more or less, no individual that bears the name of man or woman is more or less human than any other individual. We're all equally human. We all have the same potentialities, varying only in degree. And therefore, I don't want to accept anybody. I mean, I'll take the full responsibility of saying all. Though I'm not sure I hope to succeed with all. I mean, that's a different matter. I want to aim at all in order to get the maximum result we can get. I don't want to start out by saying, we'll settle for half or three quarters of the population. I don't want to name any group or any segment of the population as an exception to this principle, that they all deserve this quality of schooling. And let me say, I've had some experience with this. When Ruth Love was superintendent of schools of Oakland, which is a difficult city, the inner city school system of Oakland is not one of the better municipalities of the country. It was in the Oakland Center, I had 25 high school children, about half blacks, some Koreans, some Chinese, Japanese, some Hispanics, some whites, very mixed group, economically very mixed. About one-third of the children came from homes that had been on relief for two or three generations. It was not a selected group. They all could read well enough to read those texts. The discussion was absolutely marvelous. I've never been so lifted in my life by the intelligence of those children handling the texts, dealing with the questions, arguing with one another. At the end of the 2 weeks, they gave me a little present of a little book with their pictures and a little testimonial to me, which in effect, all of them said, this was the first time in the 12 years of their schooling that anyone had addressed their minds, had asked them questions of what they thought, asked them to defend their opinions, argue with one another. Now that, it seems to me, is an extraordinary indictment of what goes on in school. I mean, it can be done. And I can't tell you the joy they had in doing it. So that I don't think there's any problem about persuading the children. You don't turn the children off, you turn them on. And if the parents saw that, they would be turned on too.
Dr. Adler, you just said that the children you worked with indicated at the end that no one before had ever asked them what they thought.
Yeah.
And I'm very gratified to hear that, because I think that there's a tendency that's all too frequent to ask children what they feel, but much less so to ask them what they think.
Precisely.
I wanted to ask you another question. As a foreign language teacher, I'm particularly interested in that aspect of the question, and I was very gratified to see that the Paideia proposal emphasizes the importance of foreign language study. Could you explain to us a little bit why you would allow exceptionally an elective choice in foreign language study? And one other thing, why you explicitly mentioned those six languages rather than Japanese or Portuguese, and what you consider a sufficient period of time to ensure competency?
Let me answer the first question, last question first. 8 years. 8 years of the 12.
Before college,
before
yes.
College. Two, we had great difficulty about the choice. I was for Latin and Greek rather than any modern language, on the grounds that you could make the choice for the children, either Latin or Greek, as a highly inflected, syntactically subtle language, as opposed to modern languages, which would give, be very useful in understanding English grammar. I couldn't persuade my colleagues of Latin and Greek. They thought there'd be too much opposition to that. So we settled for the four most obvious common European languages and the languages of the two countries which we hope, which the future of the world, along with us, is at stake, the Far East and the most populous, the billion populated country, Chinese, and the next largest country in the world, Russia, you see. Oh, the Soviet Union. I can't defend that. I mean, we made it elective, we're pretty sure that in different parts of the country, there'd be different predominant ethnic groups that would say, we'd like for our children that foreign language. Let me ask you, if you were in the Paideia group, what would you have done? I know you'd agree that we should require a second language. What would you have done about the choice?
I wouldn't have specified any languages, I believe. I'd have asked for foreign language, yes. And I'm not sure whether that's the right answer, but I think that as soon as you specify a certain number, then the question arises as to why you've excluded others.
Of course, let me tell you, those of you who are heads of practical school systems, how much choice could you have in your school? For example, let me take your case, if I may, Mr. Houlihan. In your school, how many different languages could the children choose if it was 8 years? You're only a high school, aren't you?
Right.
Suppose you were running this unified school, 12 years divided, not 8 and 4, or 8, 6, 3 and 3, but I think the division should be 6 and 6, see? Mm-hmm. And you had it's from grade 4 on that you'd have a foreign language, or maybe even...
I think that's a real key issue, how many languages they could choose from. I can't imagine in a school, let's say, of 650, 700 students and the practical aspects involved, a student having much of a choice of more than, say, 4.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly didn't mean to suggest that a student ought to be able to choose among the whole spectrum of foreign languages. That's completely unrealistic. I simply meant that I probably wouldn't have made a specific choice. And if I had to make a choice, I'd say French.
When
I teach.
Well, that's understandable.
You'd say French, not Latin.
Then you get into a whole other issue, and that is the people that are trained to be able to teach these languages throughout the schools. You talk about a variety of different languages. They're just not, in terms of sheer numbers, there are just not that many people available.
Well, you all do know that, I think I'm right about this, maybe a few, that no major country in the world in which at least one second foreign language is not required, and some too. Our difficulty is that in almost all the other countries, the second language is English. Mm-hmm. They have no difficulty about choosing English at all because it has succeeded French as the lingua franca of the common language of business in the world and travel and everything else. So we have a more serious problem than the Japanese have, or the Danes have, or the Swedes have, where English is the one required and often a second language is a choice, a third language is a choice. I don't know the answer to the question. I think we're right about requiring a second language, not any question. But how to make that choice, I don't know.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. My guest was Mortimer Adler, the philosopher and social critic who serves as chairman of the board of editors of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Mr. Adler has recently published The Paideia Proposal, a book on educational reform about which Soundings will subsequently present other conversations. The National Humanities Center would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.